Our first interview today was scheduled several weeks ago, but it has certainly gained in importance since we set it up, because it's a discussion about terrorism, the people who commit it, and the governmental approach to stopping it. Scott Shane is a national security reporter at the New York Times and is the author of a recent book on the case of the American terror suspect Anwar al-Awlaki. Awlaki was an American citizen killed by an American drone strike in Yemen 4 years ago. He and his handling are the focus of Scott Shane's book, Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. Scott Shane has a knack as a reporter for being on important beats at important times. He was a Moscow correspondent for the Baltimore Sun when the Soviet Union collapsed and wrote a book about that. Scott's been writing about national security at the Times for more than a decade now. Scott Shane, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Jeff, thanks for having me on.
You bet. We certainly had the Paris attack since the publication of this book. I mean, what do you make just on surface of it? Is it more the same or a new approach by terrorists?
You know, it's not brand new. Probably the classic precedent for this was the Mumbai attack in 2008 in Mumbai, formerly Bombay in India, meaning guys with machine guns, basically, and bombs and grenades in some cases, and suicide vests in other cases, attacking in multiple locations in a city. That's what we saw in Mumbai, and that's what we saw on Friday night in Paris. It's sort of low-tech, relatively speaking, requires a little bit of coordination, but I think it scares the heck out of counterterrorism people, because it is it's so terrifying, so devastating, and so hard to prevent.
I read your Sunday piece on the Times website about it appears the CIA and other intelligence agencies will now press a little harder for greater surveillance rights, which could potentially mean greater curtailment of civil liberties.
Yeah, I mean, this is an old argument in American history. In some ways, it goes way back to the Alien and Sedition Acts at the beginning, not long after the founding of the country. We're a country that puts an emphasis on free speech and freedoms in general, and on privacy and on sort of the people controlling the government, not the other way around. And whenever something like this happens, it causes some people to want to kind of recalibrate the balance between, in this case, I think it's often surveillance. What should the government be allowed to do in terms of collecting phone records, which has been a hot issue for several years now, or listening in on phone calls, intercepting emails, if the goal is to prevent an attack like the one in Paris, what kind of surveillance might actually contribute to that? And what are Americans willing to put up with in terms of the government invading their, their personal space, their personal privacy?
It does seem like every time there's an incident like this or a series of incidents like this, that there's aftermath discussion of, well, there were warnings, there was chatter. I mean, is that something we're going to hear every time? Was it any more significant in this case from what you know?
Well, I think it's, from the little bit that we've picked up, there probably were some kind of communications between the attackers in Paris and folks in Syria, and that would be the kind of thing that you would expect the intelligence agencies to pick up. But it's also possible that ISIS has learned about the nature of the intelligence agencies in the West, and particularly the American ones, particularly the National Security Agency, the big eavesdropping agency located between Washington and Baltimore, America's biggest intelligence agency, and its power to sort of suck up these electronic communications. And if they learned that lesson, it's possible they used very little in the way of electronic communications, relied on face-to-face meetings either in Syria or in Paris or in Belgium. And, that kind of thing is almost impossible to pick up unless you're already following around the people involved.
So let's move now into the actual book, Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. You put the phrase Islamic terrorism in quotes, and it seems like that is often a political football. Why do you suppose the use of terminology is so important, at least to political leaders?
Well, I think it's the question of the relationship between the two parts of that phrase, Islam and terrorism. The fact is that We have, I don't know, probably close to 1.5 billion Muslims worldwide. A tiny percentage of them engage in terrorism. But those tiny percentage cite Islam, cite the Quran, cite their religion as their sort of fundamental motivation for acts of terror. So, kind of how do you unpack that? How fair is it to associate the religion with the terrorism? And, are you sort of playing into the hands of the terrorists if you lump more than 1 billion Muslims in with the terrorists? Are you, in effect alienating them, labeling them, and, potentially radicalizing some of them by taking that approach? And certainly the Obama administration has wrestled with that, as the Bush administration did, ever since 9/11. President Bush, people might remember, in the days after 9/11, he made a point of going to a mosque, mm-hmm. and declaring publicly, this, we are not at war with Islam, we are at war with terrorism, with terrorists, and with Al-Qaeda. And, that was a gesture that was appreciated at the time. But nothing has changed in that sense. That debate still goes on. A New York congressman in a story I have in today's paper, I quote a New York congressman, Peter King, as saying that we really are, we need to put aside political correctness and step up surveillance of Muslims, meaning in this country. I think that understandably upsets a lot of Muslims who are as angry about this kind of terrorism as anybody else. And I think, most counterterrorism officials would say that, at this point, almost 15 years down the road, when we have lots of experience with hunting down terrorists and disrupting plots, to sort of target an entire group, an entire religion, like all American Muslims, is an extremely inefficient and counterproductive way to go about this thing. But the debate will go on.
Indeed. Scott Shane's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, New York Times reporter on national security and the author of the book Objective Troy, about Anwar al-Awlaki and his killing by drone. The book is subtitled A Terrorist, a President, and the Rise of the Drone. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. The book does, in fact, look at Anwar al-Awlaki and Barack Obama in parallel. I mean, what similarities do you find in the stories of their families and their births in the United States?
Well, it's just sort of a coincidence, but both of these guys, meaning Barack Obama and Anwar al-Awlaki, were the sons of fathers of Muslim background who had come to the United States basically for graduate study. Both of them, they were born in the States, they were American citizens, and both Barack Obama and Anwar al-Awlaki then were taken in childhood to a Muslim country. In Obama's case, it was, of course, Indonesia, where he went with his mom for a couple of years. In the case of Anwar al-Awlaki, he went to his parents' native country, Yemen, and then they both came back to the States, both of them partly because of this complicated background, perhaps. Sort of had struggles with identity. President Obama wrote a famous, very compelling book called Dreams from My Father about his own struggles with his identity. And Awlaki's struggles, resulted in a very dramatic life course, from being a quite well-known and very successful imam in the United States, condemning 9/11, to ultimately ending up with Al-Qaeda in Yemen. So the story changes there. Barack Obama embraced America and became, astonishingly successful in politics and in government, kind of vaulted to the top of the system, and Al-Awlaki ultimately left the United States and became an enemy. and was targeted by his own country ultimately.
Give us a sense, Scott, of how rare that is in American history for a citizen to be hunted like Alaki was.
You know, it's funny. I hunted around for parallels. I mean, I should say that I discovered in the Civil War, in the U.S. Civil War, there were cases in which actually President Lincoln gave orders to, you know, hunt down these guys, some particular people fighting with the Confederate side in the Civil War, hunt them down and find them and do them in. And so it's not completely unprecedented, but, you know, obviously the comparison with the U.S. Civil War is, you know, only goes so far. Then, you know, another set of parallels might be with police shootings, very much in the news in the last year or two, in which the police decide that somebody is dangerous, you know, and some usually, you know, in a kind of momentary situation where they believe the person has a gun, and they shoot the person, obviously without criminal charges and without a trial. But I think this case is really the first of its kind, meaning hunting a guy down in a country where we are not at war, you know, based on the order of an American president, sending all of the very powerful, very expensive intelligence and security agencies that we have to find him, a process that took a year and a half and involved a whole lot of effort, you know, National Security Agency dropping basically an electronic net over Yemen, CIA going around and offering a lot of people a $5 million reward for information leading to his capture or kill, and ultimately
it really was a dead or wanted dead or alive kind of thing. I mean,
absolutely, yeah. I mean, this guy at the time that they were looking for him was judged by many people in the counterterrorism agencies to be the most dangerous person, for the United States of America on the face of the earth. And whether one accepts or rejects that analysis, that's what sort of drove the process at that time.
How did he get to this point? Our first glimpse of the work of the adult Anwar al-Awlaki was his response to the Fort Hood massacre, or at least that's the way it's portrayed in the book.
Well, actually, it goes back before that. Mm-hmm. He had this brief brush with fame in an earlier time, but maybe I should tell your listeners a little bit about this guy's story. As I said, he came from a Yemeni family. His father had moved to the States, spent almost a dozen years here as a student. He came on a Fulbright, very American story, actually, in a way. This guy came to get a technical education. He ended up with a PhD in agricultural science and went back to Yemen and became the Minister of Agriculture, chancellor of a university, founder of another university, very prominent guy. And he loved America. This is Nasser al-Awlaki, Anwar's dad. Big fan of the United States of America. He used to get up, another son told me that he used to get up early in the morning to watch Larry King live in Yemen on satellite. And they used to, his wife, the boy's mother, brought back to Yemen from America a Betty Crocker apple pie recipe, and they used to like to make apple pie. So this is a family with you know, deep ties and quite emotional ties to America, ironically enough. So when Anwar, who had spent his first 7 years in the States and spoke fluent English, reached the age of 19 in school in Yemen, finished school in Yemen, his dad, not surprisingly, sent him back to the States with the idea that he would follow in the same path, sort of become a technocrat, and, you know, come back and help Yemen, which is a country that needs help. It's the poorest country in the Arab world. It shares the Arabian Peninsula with Saudi Arabia, but basically doesn't have oil. Needs a lot of help. So he sent his son Anwar, his oldest kid, off to Colorado State to do a degree in engineering. But like a lot of kids, Anwar didn't fully take to what his father had in mind. He pursued the engineering major, but he found it boring. And interestingly, although he arrived without much interest in religion, he took a big interest in religion while he was at Colorado State. So there he is in Fort Collins, Colorado, essentially discovering Islam. And he also discovered that he had a knack for preaching. And there's a little mosque at the edge of the Colorado State campus where they can't afford to pay a professional imam, professional preacher, but so the faculty and students who are Muslim take turns giving the Friday prayers. And he found he was quite good at that. So he graduates. He spends about 6 weeks, I think it was, in an engineering job, and then says, "Dad, I can't hack this," and takes a job as a part-time imam at the Denver Islamic Society in Denver, Colorado. Does well there, gets his own mosque in San Diego where he stays for a few years, and then gets hired by a big mosque in Washington, actually right across the Potomac River in Falls Church, Virginia, but one of the biggest D.C. area mosques. And he's only 30. This is the beginning of 2001. And he's really beginning to make his mark because here's a guy who's equally fluent in English and Arabic, speaks American English without an accent, and is very good at explaining things. So as folks can imagine, when 9/11 comes along, he is sort of the right guy in the right place at the right time. And suddenly there's this hunger among many, many Americans to understand something about Islam, something about Al-Qaeda. You know, what is this thing that just happened? And he's right next to, you know, one of the country's biggest media markets and is ready to help. And so he was featured in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, on NPR, on PBS, on other networks. And he was very good at sort of explaining to Americans who are not Muslims what is this religion, what's it about. And you can find still a lot of this stuff on YouTube, mm-hmm. Where a lot of his professional work, both what you might call the good Anwar of those days and the bad Anwar of the later days, is still on display. So he became briefly for a period of months after 9/11. Fairly well known and was on the speaking circuit and was really thriving at that time.
The news media portrayed Anwar al-Awlaki as a moderate. I mean, was that a fair assumption or was it simply based on the fact that he spoke American English and sounded reasonable and all that sort of thing?
You know, when I set out to write this book, that was one of the puzzles that I kind of wanted to probe. Because even after 9/11, the FBI very quickly discovered that two of the 9/11 hijackers had prayed at Awlaki's mosque in San Diego. And they became quite worried about it and went and questioned him. The FBI went and questioned Anwar al-Awlaki outside D.C. three or four times right after 9/11. And they were still worried about him, is it possible that he could have some kind of connection to the 9/11 plot? Could he have been part of a support network for the hijackers in the States? And they set a surveillance team on him 24 hours a day in the months after 9/11. Very labor-intensive kind of thing. They tapped his phones. They kept him under, you know, the whole nine yards to try and figure out whether he was a terrorist. And the conclusion they reached is the same as the conclusion I reached, which is that actually he was not a terrorist. They concluded he had no ties to Al-Qaeda, he knew nothing about the plot, and that he was quite sincere in his condemnation of 9/11. One of the things that I did was I managed to get some of the emails he'd sent to his brother right in the week that 9/11 happened. I was able to talk to people who talked to him, you know, sort of intimate acquaintances during that period, and I concluded that he was actually infuriated by 9/11, which he thought was a huge setback for Muslims and was a disastrous thing for American Muslims in particular. And he said in a video that you can still find on YouTube, a video he made actually for the Washington Post, explaining the holy month of Ramadan. He says Islam is a religion of peace and has nothing to do with terrorism. And I think he actually believed it at the time, though understandably, given his later history, it was a reasonable question to ask.
He did go to Afghanistan at some point, and where does that figure in the timeline of what we've talked about so far?
Yeah, he when he was a student at Colorado State, he took off one winter vacation, basically, and he went to Afghanistan. And to understand this, you kind of got to throw your mind back to the pre-9/11 era, when the most famous jihad, you know, holy war, so to speak, that that anyone had heard of, was the battle of the Afghan freedom fighters, the Mujahideen, as they were called, in Afghanistan against the Soviet army, which, of course, was fighting for the sort of communist rule in Afghanistan. And this was the great cause for Ronald Reagan. It really started under Jimmy Carter, but the great cause for Ronald Reagan, great cause for, the American right, actually. Reagan supported the Mujahideen, these fighters as freedom fighters, famously, and that was the great cause supported by the United States and the CIA very actively. And in Yemen, you know, this poor Arab country, a lot of the young guys, as in other Muslim countries, said, you know what, I want to go fight with the freedom fighters with this great cause in Afghanistan. And by the time when he was a teenager growing up in Yemen, the period of time when he was going to school in Yemen, there'd be young guys in their 20s, who would come back from fighting in Afghanistan. And friends of Anwar told me that people would get together at each other's houses, and they would watch videos of the freedom fighters fighting the communist army, you know, in Afghanistan. And it was very exciting. These guys would go off to these, you know, these military heroics, and... and when they came back, they were very inspiring. So that's what prompted Anwar al-Awlaki to go on a vacation, basically, to Afghanistan.
All right, a vacation and not a real fighting one at that, it sounds like. We'll come back and talk more with Scott Shane about his book, Objective Troy, about Anwar al-Awlaki, the American killed by a drone strike in Yemen 4 years ago. It's subtitled A Terrorist, a President, and the Rise of the Drone. We'll come back and talk more with Scott and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. It's 8:36, and you're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio, online at jeffexchange.org and on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at Jeff Exchange, and of course, you can take part in our programs as they happen. We're continuing a discussion with the New York Times national security reporter Scott Shane, the author of the recent book Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. It's about Anwar al-Awlaki, the American citizen and Muslim cleric who seemed so moderate in the days right after 9/11 and then was labeled a terrorist long after that, and was taken out by an American drone, was killed by an American drone in Yemen in 2011. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I'm struck by the fact that that Anwar's father, Nasser al-Awlaki, agreed to meet with you. Now, what were those meetings like?
You know, I went to Yemen, which was not easy. It's in the middle of a civil war now. But even in early 2014, when I went there, it was pretty tough to get a visa, and there were a lot of foreigners getting kidnapped at the time, so you had to be a little careful. And Nasser al-Awlaki, who's about 70 now, you know, was somewhat reluctant to meet with me, I think partly because this is just a deeply emotional thing with him. The country that he told me he loves, still loves, had killed his son, and part of the story that we haven't gotten to, his grandson. And, you know, he was just torn up about it and found it hard to talk about. And I totally understood that. I spent even more time with Anwar's younger brother, a guy named Amar al-Awlaki, and he is, as I said, the country's in civil war now, but the younger brother sort of followed the path that their father wanted Anwar to follow, and he is now, technically speaking, although the country is not really in any kind of position for this to function, he is the deputy minister of environment and water in Yemen right now, officially speaking. So he did take that sort of technocratic path to help Yemen, a very different path from the one that Anwar ended up on.
We have a call here. Let's go to Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Scott Shane, the author of Objective Troy.
Good morning. Yes, I have two questions. One, who died with al-Maliki? And two, how is our use of missiles from drones any less terroristic than his supposed crimes?
All right, two major questions. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it.
Well, the first question is about the strike that ended up killing Anwar al-Maliki. I mean, it is maybe a little bit surprising that that Obama essentially gave the kill order in February of 2010, and it was based in part on the so-called underwear bomber, the guy who tried to blow up that plane on Christmas Day in 2009 over Detroit, who it turned out had been sort of coached and trained and sent by Anwar al-Maliki. And so that convinced Obama to put him on the so-called kill list. But it took them a year and a half or so to catch up with him. They finally found him in September of 2011 in the north of Yemen, out in a fairly wild area. And the drone strike killed Anwar al-Maliki and another American, a younger sort of sidekick of al-Maliki's named Samir Khan, a guy who'd lived in New York City and then in North Carolina and had sort of gotten radicalized and taken on. He took off and went to find Anwar al-Maliki, who he was a big fan of, in Yemen. And they worked together putting out an English-language al-Qaeda magazine called Inspire. So they were traveling together. They were traveling with two Yemeni al-Qaeda guys, and the four of them were killed in that strike. So the second question that gentleman had was, what distinguishes killing people with drone strikes, as the U.S. government does, from acts of terrorism like the kind that were encouraged and in some cases acted on by Anwar al-Maliki? And I guess it's a fairly straightforward difference. In the case of, both of these things end with dead people. But in the case of the terrorists, essentially the targets are random other than sort of nationality or location. So, for example, let's take the underwear bomber trying to blow up that plane over Detroit. It was a flight from Amsterdam to the U.S. There are people from all over the world on that flight, but a lot of Americans, 289 people. So you're trying to kill 289 random people, presumably because of the association, in this case certainly because of the association with the United States, and Anwar al-Maliki had instructed this young Nigerian underwear bomber to detonate the bomb only when the plane was over U.S. soil. So this was going to be an attack on the U.S. So they were trying to make a sort of splash in the news, politically speaking. They were trying to kill, essentially a random selection of civilians. In the case of drone strikes, the stated purpose is to, that Obama has articulated a number of occasions, is to kill people who pose a very serious threat to the security of the United States, to the lives of American citizens. And I have to say that sometimes the programs, which have been most active in Pakistan and Yemen, the drone program, has strayed well beyond that, to killing people who are targeting, in some cases, the government of Yemen or the government of Pakistan. But the idea is to try to kill individuals or groups of people that are trying to attack the United States or kill Americans. So I think you can make that distinction. I wouldn't buy the argument that it's all terrorism or that it's all the same, although we can certainly talk about the problems with the drone program, which are considerable.
Well, they're not as surgical as they're made out to be, the drone strikes, are they?
Well, I'd say the real issue is not that they're not surgical. They are quite precise, and the missiles that, the mostly Hellfire missiles that fly sort of tucked underneath the wings of the Predator drones, the Reaper drones, they really are. They can be very precise. They can, I've had people describe to me strikes, for example, where they make a hole in a roof and take out the people in one room and leave the rest of the house standing. So they can operate in a very precise manner. The problem has been more the intelligence that guides those strikes. So in it turns out, not surprisingly perhaps, to be very difficult to judge who's who on the ground from the video feed that you get from a drone. If you're the operator back in, literally in a trailer in Nevada operating these things, it's backed up by a large intelligence team. A lot of people are watching those videos. And a lot of care goes into it in many cases, but you're still looking at slightly fuzzy pictures of guys on the ground thousands of miles away. And so perhaps it's not surprising that in some cases they end up killing the wrong people. And, I can tell you a story from Yemen that might sure. help folks understand how difficult this can be. There's a case in which, a very poignant, memorable case that for me really kind of illustrates better than anything else I've heard the difficulty of carrying out these strikes in the way that they should be carried out and in the way that they can actually help national security. So there's an anti-Al-Qaeda cleric, a Muslim cleric, who gives a sermon in eastern Yemen against Al-Qaeda. He's preaching against Al-Qaeda, says, this is not Islam, this is wrong. And he subsequently gets a message, perhaps a little nerve-wracking message, that there's some guys from Al-Qaeda in the area who want to talk to him. And he's a little nervous, but he has, like everybody in Yemen's, related to everybody else, and he has some kind of familial connection to one of these guys. And so somewhat nervously, he agrees to a meeting, and they send word, hey, we don't want to hurt you, we just want to talk this over, these issues over. We think you're wrong. And so he says, okay, I'll meet with these guys. And his nephew, who's a police officer, a local police officer, says, I'll go along, make sure there's no trouble. So three guys from Al-Qaeda meet the police officer and the anti-Al-Qaeda cleric. Meanwhile, unbeknownst to them, there's a drone team, an American drone team, that is following the three Al-Qaeda guys, who are quite certain that these guys are with Al-Qaeda. So what do they see down on the ground from the unmanned aircraft up above? They see five military-aged males meeting together, perhaps somewhat secretly. They're meeting out in the open, but they're having a conversation. Three of them are known Al-Qaeda. So what do? They get permission to fire, and the judgment is made. This is five guys meeting. They must be all Al-Qaeda. And the missile hits, and all five guys are killed. So you can imagine how that plays on the ground in that part of Yemen. Here's a guy who is the ultimate ally of the United States in this campaign against terrorism, against Al-Qaeda, an anti-Al-Qaeda Muslim cleric who's Yemeni, who's preaching against Al-Qaeda, and we have just killed him, and we've killed his nephew, the police officer, and and the message that sends is perplexing and infuriating to Yemenis, and so that's how these things can go wrong.
All right. Scott Shane, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. We've got about 5 minutes left with Scott. I want to ask you about what happened in the 8 years, basically, between the September 11th attacks, when it seemed like Anwar al-Awlaki was a moderate imam, and then he was involved with the underwear bomber flying into Detroit.
Well, that was one of the reasons I set out to write this book, is to understand that question, to understand what brings a person to the point where what he wants to devote his life to is killing dozens or hundreds of strangers. And that was the path that Al-Awlaki took. And because he was an American and because he had preached against terrorism, it made that a particularly acute question. So it's sort of a long story that I unfold in the book, and it has many phases. But there's sort of an internal story and an external story. And part of the internal story is actually where sex comes into the picture. The FBI, following Anwar al-Awlaki around after 9/11, trying to figure out whether he was a terrorist, eventually concluded he wasn't a terrorist. But But what the FBI also found was that on a regular basis, every week or two, he would go meet a prostitute in a Washington hotel. And this was, you know, was a secret habit that he had. And what happened was that Alaki, who was doing, as I had said earlier, doing great as a sort of public figure, was enjoying life, was becoming quite famous, and planned to go on that way. He suddenly learns, he's tipped off by the manager of one of these escort services he's used, that the FBI has been to see this person and that the FBI has a big file on his visits to prostitutes. That terrifies him because he's a conservative preacher for a conservative congregation, and this could ruin him if it comes out. And that panicked him into leaving the United States. So there's this internal story that happens, and he's a very ambitious guy, and he needs to direct his ambition in some new direction. And at the same time, you know, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan. The U.S. then invaded Iraq, a more perplexing decision. And then eventually the U.S. is, you know, carrying out drone strikes in several countries. And I think the, you know, the sort of argument that had not made sense initially to Anwar al-Awlaki, that the U.S. was at war with Islam, began to seem more and more plausible, more and more attractive. And again, you have this sort of burning ambition. He ends up in Yemen. He's actually imprisoned for a year and a half without charges. And when he gets out of prison, basically he joins al-Qaeda. So that's the story in a nutshell that I unspool in much greater detail in my book.
Let's take a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Scott Shane, the author of Objective Troy.
Good morning. And one thing here, I'm going to cite Curtis LeMay and Japan and Dresden as the kind of terror things that we can do in contrast to drones. But my concern is, fine, we have this technology, fine, we can do these more or less surgical things, whether we get them right or not. But to me, this does not solve the underlying problem that leads to the asymmetrical warfare in the first place. What is going to solve that problem? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, thanks for that, Paul.
Well, you know, we need another hour to talk about that one. But I think the you know, one of the things that you realize when you think about this this long conflict between the United States and this particular strain of Islam is that on the one hand, I think all the spending we've done and souped-up surveillance and so on has actually made this country much safer, much less vulnerable to attack. But at the same time, a lot of what we've done, including drone strikes, has generated a backlash that has actually spread this message that the U.S. is at war with Islam. And I think it's probably fair to say today that the minority of Muslims around the world who believe the U.S. is their enemy is greater than it was in 2001. And that, you know, that is very worrisome for the long run. And certainly ISIS is a very disturbing reflection of that.
So what, I guess, you know, you're not the guy in charge, I know, but I mean, so how do you defend yourself without being offensive to people who then would take this as a sign that indeed you are just as big and as bad as they've been told?
Well, you know, I think that's the big question. You know, some people believe that in an ideological conflict, which this is, certainly is, that just bumping off enemies is not necessarily ultimately going to solve the problem, and that it has to be approached more on a sort of a cultural and ideological basis. And that's, you know, and actually the U.S. as a multicultural country with a significant Muslim population, a lot of Muslims who are thriving patriotic Americans, and a country that has a history with, you know, Hollywood and Madison Avenue of being adept at sort of sending messages, you know, maybe there are other approaches to this problem other than bumping people off. But I have a feeling that with things like we saw in Paris, with attacks like we saw in Paris, and the continuing determination of some folks out there with al-Qaeda and ISIS to attack the United States, that we'll still see the use of hard power as a big part of this problem for for a long time.
Yeah, a little doubt about that. Well, I'm glad we certainly had a chance to talk to you about the subject matter of your book, but also glad we got to talk to you at this time after the Paris attacks. Scott Shane is from the New York Times and the author of Objective Troy. Scott, thanks for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, take care.